Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Joining me in a moment is Sir Paul Tucker, the former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, who spent 33 years at the Old Lady of Threadneedle Street, serving on the Bank's Monetary Policy Committee from 2002 until 2013, and who had responsibility for UK banking stability during what were the most challenging times that sector's faced since the 1930s. Subsequent to his retirement from the Bank of England, Paul became a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and published his first book, Unelected Power, in 2018, in which he questioned the place of central bankers, technocrats and regulators in a post-GFC world and sought to try and understand how their roles would inevitably change in the wake of 2008. This year saw the publication of Paul's second book, Global Discord, which is a superbly rich look at how we need to think about sustaining a system of international cooperation in a world riven by geopolitical struggle, domestic political division, and of course the rise of China as a threat to America's hegemony. Now, both Paul's books make for excellent and thought-provoking reading, and his willingness to challenge the community in which he spent the vast majority of his career is something I found uniquely refreshing. So I'm absolutely delighted to have the chance to welcome Paul to the podcast. Well, Paul, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I'm thrilled to have the chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to do it. I'm really glad.
Well, the promotional tour for your superb book has died down now, so hopefully it's not just a whirlwind of public appearances and podcasts and panels and all sorts of things.
There are still some going on, but it's less intense than it was. And of course, 5 months in, things have happened in the world as well. And I'm kind of relieved to say that I still feel the book is relevant. And yeah. I hope I'd be honest with myself about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll come on to Global Discord shortly. But I wanted to begin with your first book, actually, Unelected Power. Most people who were in positions within the central bank community during the global financial crisis wrote books which talked about their personal experiences during, you know, what were obviously crazy times and very high pressure. But you didn't. You know, you wrote a book that discussed the questions around how power has been given to unelected central bankers. And your book was much more forward-looking and much, I thought, grander in scope than a lot of these kind of personal accounts. And it felt like you were seeking to understand what went wrong and perhaps more importantly, suggest ways in which going forward, things could and should be done better. Now, was that a question that arose while you were in the middle of that, or was it more reflective afterwards? And as we stand here, you know, a matter of weeks after the latest banking crisis, one I have to say I suggest and suspect is far from over, do you think lessons have been learned, or are we making the same mistakes, inevitable mistakes that follow from the last set of mistakes?
Great question, the last bit. On the first bit, I wasn't the only Brit that wrote a different style of book, not a memoir. Mervyn King wrote a book about banking, really, and the monetary system. Adair Turner, who had been the chief regulator, wrote a book about debt. And I think there is something, not about us individually, but a bit about our culture, which is the thing about writing memoirs is for the people that follow you, they know that their colleagues are taking notes and planning to write a memoir.
Right.
So maybe some countries are in that position. And I think we owe it to our successors to kind of not leave them wondering who's keeping a diary or whatever in the way that Americans do and some continental Europeans. That's the trivial thing, much more than that. It was reflecting on it, but not after I'd left public office, actually before, in that after the crisis, banking supervision was returned to the Bank of England with bigger powers. These days, people call them macroprudential powers, which just means a system as a whole. Bigger powers in some respects than we had had before 1997, when the new Labour government made the Bank of England independent of monetary policy and transferred responsibility for banking stability to a new regulatory organisation. And that didn't work out so brilliantly because it's very hard to separate the banking supervisor from the lender of last resort. That's, I think, the key argument for having them together. And the lender of last resort is inevitably the central bank. But I was one of the architects, perhaps one of the chief architects in truth, of the new system centered around the bank and elsewhere in the UK. And we were encouraged by some people in government to take on even more powers. And we said, no, thanks. That would make us too powerful. And on some of the powers that did come the Bank of England's way, we said, well, actually, this needs to be more constrained than it is, so that the really big choices are being made by elected people rather than unelected people. And then when the UK retail banks were ring-fenced, they're kind of separated from the groups that they're part of, initially government wanted us to kind of flesh out all of the details. And Mervyn King and I said, no, you should flesh out the big details, again, because ministers are elected and we're not. And so when I left the Bank of England at the end of 2013 and moved to Harvard, and I knew I wanted to write a book about this kind of stuff, and what I wanted to write down so was essentially, what's going on in the back of my mind when I'm saying, no, that would make us too powerful, or this is for elected people, and what are the principles for that? And you're right that it had some bearing on the future and was meant to have some bearing on the future, because basically my argument was there are good democratic rule of law, constitutional kind of reasons. So for all rich democracies, of having an independent central bank responsible for stability of prices, low and stable inflation, a stable banking system, broadly defined, but not being responsible for, I don't know, climate change or inequality, right, however important those things are. And of course, they're incredibly important. And it's not the easiest thing in the world to argue that actually the central bank shouldn't be leading on these things, because it can come across as maybe these people don't think it's that important. And it isn't that at all. It's just in our way of life, it's important that unelected people aren't responsible for too much, and that what they are responsible for reflects a consensus in society and can be monitored. But yes, I do think central banks are responsible for banking stability, and we've had a little bit of a banking wobble, to put it lightly.
But do you think the immediate reaction, particularly the kind of guaranteeing of all the deposits of Silicon Valley Bank, was that a considered plan forward, or was that, again, reacting in the moment and not necessarily thinking through how the dominoes may topple after making a decision like that?
I mean, I don't know. But it looks like improvisation on the run. Often, if you don't prepare, if you haven't laid the ground carefully, and yet a fire catches and spreads, you end up having to do more dramatic things than you would have had to do had you only prepared. I mean, in the American case, this is a real problem, because in 2019, the US regulatory authorities, including the central bank, the Federal Reserve, decided to cease planning for how to handle the failure of large regional banks. And at the time, I was chair of something called the Systemic Risk Council, which was a transatlantic group of former top central bankers and regulators. I mean, incredibly famous names like Paul Volcker, God rest his soul, Jean-Claude Trichet, Sheila Bair, Madeleine Turner, now Belling, who chaired the Basel Committee. And we wrote to them public letter and said, you don't want to stop planning for how to resolve these large regional banks, because it's not as that we don't think you've got a plan already and you can kind of put that on the shelf and be ready. We don't think you've got a plan. And these things are quite reliant on wholesale liabilities, which is another language for other words for uninsured deposits. And if one of them ever gets into trouble, there'll be contagion, and they're pretty big. I mean, I say this with no pleasure, negative pleasure, and that's almost exactly what happened. And so they hadn't got a plan, and then they end up effectively saying, here's a government guarantee, rather like the Irish did for the whole of their banking system in the previous crisis. I can remember exactly where I was standing when I heard about the Irish guarantee, and it was one of the few moments of the whole crisis where I was kind of, oh my God, because I thought, all the money is going to flow from everywhere into the Irish banks because they're now guaranteed, until they realize that the size of the banking sector is now beyond the capacity of the Irish state to guarantee it. And then it will all flow out again.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, hearing you talk about this power that central banks have, and it's fascinating for someone outside that community that spends their life looking inwards at it and trying to understand what's going on. You know, we definitely get this sense, I think that quite apart from saying we don't want more power, there's a sense from investors that central banks have craved more power. So it's really interesting to hear that because, you know, when we saw after the global financial crisis, fiscal policymakers did not want to step into that breach, and it was left to monetary policymakers to try to fix everything. And I guess the question that I've always wondered about is, it seemed as though at the point where the baton should be passed back to fiscal and pressure put on fiscal policymakers to step in and do things that would be much more targeted to places they needed to go rather than sending asset prices higher, I'm curious as to why when fiscal policymakers didn't step up, it felt like central banks felt almost duty-bound, okay, well, we're going to have to do this. Was that the case? Or in hindsight, perhaps should there have been more, okay, well, we've done our bit, over to you, you need to act here?
No, I agree with you about that, and I've said that before in public, as have others. I think the predicament central bankers are in is slightly more awkward than you get up there, and I'll try to explain that. I think the moment for handing over the baton was, I don't know, 2014, 15, 16. I don't want to be too precise about it. I push it out that far because the euro area crisis was a kind of big thing. I mean, if you go back to the beginning, those of us that were involved in starting QE, I don't think any of us would have thought that it would have gone on for years and years and years. And I think we'd have been very concerned if God had told us that it was going to go on that long. I think when the euro area crisis happened, for a country like the UK, Charlie Bean, my former colleague, summed this up very well at the time in one of our meetings, saying these are circumstances in which actually we can try to stimulate demand, or actually fiscal policy could try to stimulate demand, but it's not going to do much good because if the euro area completely unravels, households, families, small businesses are going to wish that they'd saved a bit more to see them through the cataclysm. So that kind of pushed out the moment for handing over the baton, it's now yours. And I said before that I think if things had somehow panned out where Mervyn King was the governor of the Bank of England a few years later than he was, I can see him in the mid-teens kind of saying, no more from us. We can't do any more now. But here's the predicament. And I think Mario Draghi got close to articulating this, although not in quite the way I think would have been ideal, which is, it's a sequential game for anyone that's watching your show that likes game theory. It's a Staffelberg game. And the fiscal policy moves first, and the monetary policy maker moves second. So you're the finance minister, you're the treasury secretary, and I'm the central banker, or I'm the advisor to the central banker. Something terrible has happened. The economy's been whacked. And I come to you and we have a meeting and we agree we should both do something. There should be some fiscal stimulus and there should be some monetary stimulus, and you're sincere, and we're just talking the economics and the best approach, and I leave the room and you're left with your political advisors. And this story works best for America, but actually it applies everywhere in a different way. And your political advisors say you're going to have to carry the House, you're going to have to carry the Senate, you're going to have to carry your donors. There are some members of the cabinet that aren't happy with this, some of the commentators aren't happy with this. Political science calls this political transaction costs. I mean, you're going to have to pay a price politically for doing the right thing. And you want to do the right thing. And so you argue a bit with your political advisors, but they carry on. They're really beating you about. And you eventually say to them, so what happens if I don't do my bit? And they say, oh, he'll do more. And he has to do more, and they'll try to do more within the limits of his or her mandate. Because unlike you, the finance minister, you've got no statutory obligations. The central banker has a legal obligation to try and meet their inflation target within the constraints of their mandate. And Draghi articulated that. I mean, he was often saying, we'll do what we can within the constraints of our mandate. I think some people say, oh, the central bankers should have said, the fiscal policymakers should be doing more. And some of your viewers, listeners may remember that Draghi actually did that at a Jackson Hole conference in America some little time after I'd left office. And without wanting to go into it too much, my impression is that top German politicians, and I mean top German politicians, were pretty irritated or discombobulated by that. And when I've been asked about that, I tended to say, actually, with hindsight, as it were, because Mario is a pretty shrewd operator, for goodness sake, the best thing to say is, we're done. We're done. not about what others should do, they're elected, but about what you can't do. If you like to trivialize it a bit, you need to present yourself as naked. But that's going to discombobulate the markets. And so it takes nerve to do that. And yet, if you look back from 2023 to the mid-teens, I think many people wish that something like that had happened, because what did happen instead, flat yield curve forever, which was kind of QE meets forward guidance, with fueling, I don't know whether it's a bubble, but speculative excess in the credit markets and elsewhere, and pushing up asset prices. And so fueling this sense that there's some deep unfairness in it all. Whereas if fiscal policy had done more, the yield curve would have been upward sloping, asset prices wouldn't have risen as much, and the politicians would have been in a better position to choose, not quite the right word, which parts of the economy and society to help and which parts not to help. So I don't think the historians will be terribly kind about all of this, but I think the central bankers, these are the central bankers after me, I think they were in a bit of a corner, frankly.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to global discord. I mean, what a wonderful title for a book, given the times we're living in, because it seems like discord is all around us. So I'd love to kick off just very broadly, what inspired you to write that? And if you can, I was fascinated this idea that the US and China are France and Great Britain in the 19th century. If you could talk about that a little bit. Sorry, 18th century, beg your pardon. If you could talk about that a little bit, because I think that's such an interesting parallel that not many people have made.
Well, thank you for that. And none of these parallels are perfect. So first of all, what motivated the book, a kind of minor thing and a much bigger thing. The minor thing was that my previous book on elective power was, is it okay to delegate so much power to domestic agencies like central banks and regulators and whatnot, not just in finance, but across the piece. And that kind of didn't address, well, we also pool loads of power internationally and we delegate to international organizations, you know, in trade. The appellate body of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, is incredibly powerful, more powerful than any trade department in a particular country. So that was the minor thing. That was just an extension, if you like. And then, as I thought about it, I realized that, of course, whereas in a country like ours, Britain or the United States or wherever, we can kind of take peace and stability and order for granted. When I leave the house later, I'll feel perfectly safe. And this is a political achievement. And internationally, it depends upon peaceful existence among states. And history tells us that's not to be taken for granted. I'm probably a bit older than you, but we happen to have lived our lives under conditions where, for us, thankfully, we could take peaceful coexistence for granted.
Yeah.
Even during the Cold War, not quite to be taken for granted, but maintained. And I thought, well, actually, all these international organizations I'm thinking about in economics and beyond, they all reflect the fact that the Western powers have kind of been the most powerful states since the Second World War, essentially because Stalin chose to take the Soviet bloc out of all of the economic regimes. I mean, an incredible bit of mid-20th century history is the Soviets were at the Bretton Woods Conference on the monetary regime. They were involved in the GATT negotiations. In fact, the big hotel up in New Hampshire where the Bretton Woods negotiations take place. I have stayed in the room, not by choice, on what conference. I was allocated to the bedroom that was used as an office by the Soviets, which is quite a thing. But anyway, Stalin took the Soviet bloc out of that. So although there was a security contest, and obviously proxy wars, very nasty proxy wars and so on, and some near misses in the nuclear front, etc., in the economic field, essentially, the Western world had the world to itself. And it's not like that now. I mean, in telling that story of what motivated me, I wanted to think about, and so what does that mean for international cooperation, given that China has risen and it's got a completely different history, a completely different set of values and norms about how to govern domestically and internationally? Oh, goodness, that's a bigger project than my previous one. And so this brings me to the 18th century parallel. So I think the best way to think about this contest, which I'm going to call it, is that it's quite likely to go on for decades and decades. It could go on for half a century or a century. And it will be everywhere and in everything. And neither side will be capable of knocking out the other in a kind of easy way. And it's ideological. So if you compare that with other things, it's not like the Cold War in one key respect. So the Cold War between the Soviets and the West was, it was everywhere. And it was ideological. And the two sides couldn't knock each other out. But it wasn't in everything, which is what I've been describing. It wasn't really in commerce. Then if you go to another comparison that's made, which, you know, to use the old-fashioned language, the Second German Reich and Britain at the end of the 19th century, turn of the 20th century, well, that was closer to being in everything and everywhere. The German economy, and especially the British economy, including the city of London, were very intertwined. First World War came as a terrible shock to the city of London, including the organization I used to work for. And again, they were going to struggle to knock each other out. But it wasn't especially ideological. It was about power. The last time I think you can see a really big struggle that was everywhere, everything, evenly matched and ideological is Britain and France from 1689 to about 1815. And the ideological bit, I think, is important. At the beginning of the 18th century, Britain's problem with France, they had a problem with us, by the way, but Britain's problem with France was the universalist ambitions of absolute monarchy. By the end of the 18th century, it was the universalist ambitions of revolution. Edmund Burke, the Irish-British thinker, parliamentarian, writer, during the end of the 18th century, said something like, the problem isn't France's power, it's that it's the wrong kind of power. And in a sense, that just sums up rather nicely. We haven't got a problem with Chinese people, for goodness sake. We haven't got a problem with Chinese civilization and history, which is kind of marvelous. We've got a problem with the party and their relentless control of their own society and the relentless holding on to power. And I think what's instructive about that is conveying the kind of sense, oh, this could go on for a very, very long time. And this matters to people that are more interested in markets and the economy, etc. So lots of people who are pretty damn expert on the Chinese economy and financial system will say, but there are all of these vulnerabilities in the financial system and provincial authority, property stuff and credit booms and whatnot, and all of which I can say more carefully and all of which I think is broadly true. And it could crack at some point. Don't think it's inevitable, but it could, might next week. And I think if and when it does crack, I expect people around Wall Street, City, and elsewhere to say, that's it, then all over, back to normal.
Right.
It's like Japan in the 1990s or something. And my message, it's quite a simple one in a way, is don't believe that when it happens, unless it dislocates Chinese society and Chinese politics. But that's a metric. We may have dislocation in Western politics. I mean, it's not like Japan. Japan, when they had their crack in the 90s, they were under the US security umbrella. They were deep allies in security. It was an economic contest, which essentially the Japanese stumbled. Whereas this is much bigger, and China could move sideways for a while and continue to expand their military and just not allow consumption and other things to grow as much as would have been the case otherwise, and I suspect they could sustain that. None of this so far, by the way, is meant, apart from the point about the party, none of it's kind of meant to be anti. It's meant to be just be descriptive. You know, let's recognize what it is. This is really big.
Well, it's interesting to me. I heard you talking, I'm not sure, I listened to a number of interviews and stuff, but I heard you talking about China's ambitions as understandable. And I found that really fascinating because that doesn't seem to be the general stance taken by policymakers, at least not out loud. That's kind of the unspoken part. If we admit they're understandable, then we're giving them legitimacy. So talk a little bit about how you see that, because I just thought that was such a fascinating observation and one I completely agree with.
I don't mean understandable as something we should necessarily applaud.
No, absolutely right.
But just actually that we can make sense of it, that if you're a rising power, I mean, they're a great power now, it's understandable that they should want their currency to be used widely around the world rather than the dollar being the dominant currency. I mean, you know, some continental Europeans feel like that about the dollar. I think that's rather misjudged on their part. Or that China is frustrated with not only the United States on its own, but the European countries together having an effective veto at the IMF. They'd say, well, actually, you know, we're the second biggest or something. And we should have much more voting rights at the IMF. I'm not in favor of giving them that yet, to be clear. But I think that we're not going to be able to navigate this challenge unless, up to a point, we can climb into their minds. And the things I've just said would be true of any rise of power. This is where the analogy between the Second German Reich and Britain is quite good. I mean, at the end of the 19th century, Germany felt that their power wasn't sufficiently recognized in the world and that we were blocking them. And, you know, that problem recurs throughout history for thousands of years. It's not just something that I think this is, you know, for talking about over a pint or something or in a scholarly seminar. I think this matters to policymakers. I think we've got no chance of serving ourselves and serving our people, let alone the world, unless we can distinguish between, well, they would do that, wouldn't they? And what, you know, is that okay for us? Those are separate questions. So, you know, there's this thing, talk about containing China. I mean, I don't think, in big picture, one has to break this down a bit, big picture, I think that's just not a very helpful way of thinking about it. I find it much more helpful to think about three things. First of all, I have been in favor of what people now call some decoupling, reducing overdependence in areas where it really, really matters, you know, kind of most elementally. You don't want your military to be supplied by the key things from the other side, as it were. And I was saying things like that before COVID and before Russia's war on the Ukraine. The second thing, though, and I think the United States, Washington, haven't been terribly good at this over some decades, this is a world where we need lots of friends. We need friends in Africa and Latin America and East Asia and everywhere. The silliest thing, to put it slightly harshly, that I've occasionally heard in Washington and elsewhere in the States, not very frequently, but occasionally, is, well, actually, we can handle this on our own. We don't even need Europe. To which my response is, well, actually, that might turn out to be true. It might. But it really might turn out not to be true at all. So that if China continued to grow, I'm not saying they will, but if they were to continue to grow pretty rapidly for another 20 years, they're just going to be absolutely gigantic. And you bet me, Washington will need European friends. But actually, in these things, you need friends everywhere. And that friends aren't the same as allies. And that can involve respecting people's neutrality a bit and understanding their predicament. But the third thing, and this will bring us back to where we started, is it's absolutely vital not to make mistakes. I'll give you a trivial example that was cancelled out. So when I was in office, must be 2009 or something, someone walked into my room and said, Federal Reserve have just refused India a swap line. Doesn't matter what a swap line is. It's just a kind of line of credit from one central bank to another. And it was to help India navigate the global financial crisis, which for God's sake had been caused by the United States itself. And the Fed had said no. This was decided. Someone was telling me the decision. My response was, don't they realize India is going to be a power? My point was, this is above the central banker's pay grade.
Yeah.
Or more carefully, fine for the central bank to say no, but you then need a diplomatic démarche from the White House or the State Department or whatever to Delhi to put it in its broader context and smooth things out. I mean, so that was an unforced error, I think.
Yeah.
But go forward just a few years, 2020, I thought the biggest thing that happened in 2020 wasn't COVID, and I had COVID pretty badly, so I'm not making light of, and many people had it much worse than I did and lost dear ones. I'm not making light of that at all. But I think for history, the biggest thing was the border skirmish between China India. And the almost immediate effect of that was the Indian government wanting to revive the Indo-Pacific Quad of India, Australia, Japan, and the States, which Prime Minister Abe of Japan had initiated in his first term, and India had ended up being really lukewarm about. And then there's this border incursion, and it's like that thing that's happened to everyone in business or in public office, like me, or frankly, every family or every just individual, which is, you know, that idea that we thought was really bad.
Yes.
It turns out to be really good. It's kind of not, you know, I shouldn't be frivolous about these things, but it kind of conveys the switch. That border incursion led to the revival of the Quad. And actually, the day we're recording this, the news has come that because of the debt negotiations in Washington, the Quad meeting that was going to take place in Australia actually is going to take place in Japan on the margins of the G7 meeting there. And the fact that that's global news, it's not Biden has to go back to Washington because of no one knows what it is. It's the Quad's being moved. So the Quad's become a big thing. And I think it's just an illustration of the importance of not making mistakes. And where this goes back to where we started is somewhere in my book, I say, and actually it's true whether or not I've said it, is the West can't afford another financial crisis.
Right.
I mean, the wobbles that have recently happened in the States and in Switzerland, these were avoidable. And it's important for us to realize, and actually, I don't actually mean people like you and people like me. I mean power holders to realize that financial stability is now a national security issue, just as the debt ceiling negotiation is. I mean, my slogan, if you like, that I've used before is vote default, vote Beijing.
Right, right.
I mean, if they default, they're great winners on planet Earth from this debt ceiling negotiation ending up in technical default. None of the big winners are in the United States of America. They're in Beijing.
Yeah, it's such an interesting idea because prior to this particular set of negotiations, and there are all kinds of minutiae that make this one different to previous ones that have happened, the general theory has been, well, the Chinese own so many treasuries that it would be a disaster for them if, you know, it's such kind of first order thinking. And so, you know, that brings us to, you know, the financial system in this world of global discord, as you so beautifully describe it. We have constraints around us which we haven't had to this extent previously. And that's debt levels, obviously, which are significantly higher than we've seen in previous periods of stress. The demographic changes, which have been coming for a long time. And like many of these things, people see them as oil tankers so far out in the water, they don't see the wake coming towards them. How does this idea of trying to align incentives and values in this deeply disconnected world, how is that constrained by the increased problem of debt, the increased problem of demographics, and increasingly domestic politics?
Well, it kind of is, of course, is the first and most important thing to say. Although there's a peculiar silver lining, at least for my former world, in the demographic thing. The first thing to say, though, is why do I labor this in the book? I mean, the book has a low road, which is about policy, geopolitics, geoeconomics, and a higher road about how to think about all these things. Why? And it's because it's a strange state of affairs, but it's as it is. The standard menu of people that think about these things at a high level are, it's all about power and nothing else really matters. Or it's all about interests and economic independence and actually everything else really comes down to that. Or a third school would be, it's all about values and human rights and things. It's kind of pretty obvious that in the real world, the moment the man and whoever sits in the Oval Office in the future and heads of government in London, Berlin, and Paris and elsewhere, it's about all three. And why does any of this matter to begin with? I mean, it matters because we think our way of life matters to us and that we shouldn't lose it. And by our way of life, we don't mean the fact that I like to go around the corner for a little pint on my own occasionally. We mean that we, as a political community, we decide things by voting and we have the rule of law and an independent judiciary and powers are separated so that not one person has got all the levers of government power. And actually, although we take it for granted, it's an extraordinary achievement. And they live in a different way, with a different history. And we somehow need to find a way where the very core of our way of managing ourselves and living together as within our countries as a political community and but among our states, that isn't in jeopardy as a new great power with a completely different tradition arises. And that's the first time we've had that really, you know, 300 years or so. So going through your things, I mean, the silver lining with the demographics is that as we had an aging population, people had incentives to save for their old age. And that added to extraordinary saving in East Asia after the 90s crisis and extraordinary saving in China. And that pushed down the world real interest rate. And that pushed nominal interest rates, the things that we actually see in the world, closer to zero. And that left central bankers with less capacity to support the economy. In my generation, we moved from 5 to 0 very quickly and then did some quantitative easing. Whereas, you know, we've just been through a decade in which people thought maybe they'd only be at 2, which is just not enough. And actually, the demographic phase we're entering, this may push, as there are fewer old people to cater for, if you like, to save for our own future, that may push the world real interest rate up. And if that happens, Charles Goodhart's written a book about this, that's a kind of profound and helpful thing. But in other respects, of course, it's very difficult because what we have discovered, and more people have some experience of this in their immediate family, is, if you like, putting it very crudely, as fewer people die of other diseases, then they fall victim to dementia or Alzheimer's, and our social care systems everywhere are tremendously challenged by that. And that adds to the pressure on ordinary people because they're looking after their parents or other relatives in a period where growth is very low. Nothing to do with recessions, actually, even before the last financial crisis, underlying growth was low. And this is terrible. You imagine a world, we're not in this world yet, so this is just to kind of conjure the thought. Imagine a world where there is no per capita GDP growth. So I'm adjusting for more people turning up in the country or whatever. There's none. And that's a world in which you and I are only both better off in terms of income if everybody else is worse off. People in the street I'm sitting in, if we can only be better off if everybody else in the country is worse off in terms of income. And the point about this is that every single policy, apart from defense maybe, becomes distributional. And distributional policy is tough and sometimes toxic. And we have all grown up in a world where distributional clashes happen through politics, right-wing parties, left-wing parties, whatever, centrist parties. But actually, there was also growth that kind of made it easier. And you don't have to believe in the so-called trickle-down theory to know that growth actually makes all of that. You know, there hasn't been enough trickle-down. I'm not being complacent about the past. But a world with no growth, a world in which people are looking after their elderly parents and relatives, and there's, on average, there's very little income growth, is going to create societal tensions or tensions in our own societies, just when, if you like, we need to be on top form to face and cope with, without going over the top against, the rise of a completely different great power. So the combination of domestic stress and shifted geopolitics, we need bigger, wiser leaders than we've needed for, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 years. It's a hell of a thing.
Yeah, which is problematic when one looks around the world in a search for kind of those kinds of leaders. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's a reality we have to face at the moment, sadly. I mean, I don't know if these times create those leaders, or the leaders we have create the need for those leaders and they emerge. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. I just don't see that, unfortunately, as option one that we have. That may be a byproduct, but I don't know where we go. I'm conscious of your time. Just a couple more things, if I can. One of those, we've talked about the dollar and swap lines a little bit earlier on. I want to come back to that because a big part of the order, a big part of the world that you described prior to the onset of this discord wave, had the dollar at its center, and the dollar as a reserve asset and a reserve currency. And so I'm curious as to the struggles that we're seeing now, more and more the dollar is being placed front and center in those struggles, whether it's we want to move away from the dollar, which, again, understandable. We come back to that word understandable. There are perfectly good reasons why these countries would want to not do business in the dollar. Has the US's strength, which was the dollar, become its Achilles heel due to the debt that's built up over it and the problems the US has domestically in terms of now more than ever needing the world to need dollars?
Well, it always potentially is for the world's principal dominant reserve currency issuer. Well, neither of us remembers this, but many of your listeners and viewers will know that in the 60s under the Bretton Woods regime, de Gaulle said to the Americans, "Here are your dollars, give me my gold." I mean, bloody hell.
Yes. We know we said it. We didn't actually mean it.
No. And of course, the thing that's going on in his mind is that he doesn't think that the Americans are going to be able to sustain the value at their peg, which they weren't in that, able to do that. And then when Bretton Woods fell apart, unraveled, there was real concern about whether America could maintain, if you like, a worthwhile dollar, which ultimately means low and stable inflation at home. And that was a world with capital controls everywhere. In today's world, it means the Americans need the Fed to be on form on monetary policy, which ultimately means maintaining low inflation. It means that they need a stable banking system, and they need to ensure that the shadow banking system, not only in America, but elsewhere in the world, doesn't have explosive demands for dollar help, which floods the world with dollars. And it also ultimately means that the US can't be indifferent about the scale of its external debt, and therefore it can't be indifferent about the scale of its government debt, but also its household debt. I mean, American external debt hasn't always been driven by the state, which is what, you know, some people would have you believe. And that's true sometimes, and it's been true recently a bit. But actually, you know, this is true of Britain as well. In the run-up to the great financial crisis, you've basically got a debt-fueled consumer splurge, and we're financing that from abroad.
Yeah.
The good thing is, and this is an important thing to hold on to, is we, the UK and the Americans, have financed our external deficits in our own currency.
Right.
Financing it in a foreign currency is a much more risky thing to do. But nevertheless, even with low world interest rates, there is a point, but no one knows where it is, where people would become concerned about the dollar. And so, you know, basically the American elite or establishment, or whatever you call it, they've got to come together on some things. I mean, they have got a shared interest in American, U.S. financial stability. Not just talking about banks now, but more generally. And if they lose that, then that would actually, again, be a gift to the rest of the world, the unfriendly parts of the rest of the world. So they must be careful. But that doesn't mean that having a game over the debt ceiling, where if they can't resolve it, they technically default, is the best way through. Because what will then happen is the world will be full of bankers and consultants saying, I would just shave down the proportion of your reserves in dollars if I were you. We've seen that America is a dysfunctional society. One day this technical default could be much worse. You just want to reduce your exposure. And initially that may even go into euros. But we have to remember that one can overstate this, but Europe, including the British Isles, we live under an American security umbrella. The sea lanes are kept open for trade today by the American Navy in the way that in the past they were kept open by the British Navy. And part of the point of my book is to bring all of these things a bit closer to the surface so that we remember that actually, even when we're sometimes frustrated with the United States, they do actually defend us and they keep the sea lanes open.
Absolutely. And I think you do a really good job of doing that in the book. It's clear how important that stuff is, and frankly, how under-discussed it is. These aren't generally things. They kind of throw away lines these days about the country with the strongest military is always the hegemon and all this on this kind of thing. But just one last question, as I say, I'm conscious of your time. Part of this, the discord, does it necessarily mean lower standards of living in the West? Because Hugh Pill famously a couple of weeks ago said, unfortunately, and he subsequently apologized, and I felt sorry for him then, and I feel sorry for him now, but he made a comment which seems actually rooted in absolute truth, that people have to understand that they're not as wealthy as they thought they were, and they should expect slightly lower standards of living. Is that part of this great global discord that the West has to accept this, do you think?
Yeah, so one has to be very careful here.
Yeah.
There's a war. There's been an energy price spike, or more than a spike, frankly. They've gone through the ceiling. Talking about Britain, we import nearly all of our own energy, or lots and lots of our own energy. I picked the UK not because I'm sitting in it, because actually it's the best example almost. Yeah. This is a little better of the United States. Therefore, the country is poorer. The country. Or in econ speak, in aggregate, we are poorer. But that doesn't mean everyone is poorer, or that everyone needs to be poorer. Who ends up poorer than they would otherwise have been depends upon markets and inflation and government choices. And actually, those choices, other than getting inflation back to target, those choices aren't for central bankers. I mean, I think a useful thing, and, you know, Mervyn and I had a pretty big disagreements about some things, but when the energy price thing went up, Mervyn would have been fantastic at saying, actually, the country's poorer. This isn't something the central bank can do anything about. We can bring inflation back. Some pretty big questions for government here, but they're not for us. And I think it's a pity. I'm not pointing this at the Bank of England and my former colleagues. This is true of all central bankers. I think rather than talking about the energy price shock as producing transitory inflation, I think that they could have unpacked that a bit more. And actually, in the course of it, explained to the country, or explained to people in all of our countries, that these are challenges for government rather than for central banks. But if you broaden it away from the particular energy price shock, one can think of it in another way. I mean, let me conclude perhaps on this. In the proof stage of the book, which is kind of the very last stage, I had to tweak a few sentences because I had thought Putin wouldn't make his move against Ukraine until and unless leader Xi or somebody, future leader, moved against Taiwan. And the reason I thought that is I thought, stretch Washington on two fronts simultaneously. Now, in that extent, actually, Putin has given away some optionality because Washington now knows that it's got at least two fronts. Behind that is a bigger thought, which is maybe a greater share of our national income and output will need to go into defense. Well, that will mean less of it will go into consumption goods and leisure. When people compare living standards and between Europe and the United States, one of the things they have to do is they make more military kit and have less leisure. I mean, that's the deal in a sense. And they get to be world leaders. And we get a bit more leisure and we get to specialize a bit more in things that are nice for us people. In a world that's risky, maybe we can't be concentrated so much on the production of lovely things or things that people need at home, although that should stay, of course. But maybe there'll have to be a bit more going into defense. In headline terms, this is the debate about spend 2% of your budget on defense, which the Americans have complained about to Europe for years. And I think Britain has pretty well got back to approaching where they would like us to be. But these are serious times. I mean, they're much more serious. I lived through some pretty grim financial and economic crises, you know, the UK going into the RM, falling out, and various bank failures, but all with peaceful coexistence in the background as a given. And the stakes are higher now, and they somehow need to navigate this without overreacting. So I would like some decoupling, but I don't want us to fall into 1930s protectionism. I mean, people have said to me, well, how do you do that? And there isn't a rule you can write down. It requires careful judgment.
Yeah, and statesmen, unfortunately. Yeah, it's a shame that this, as you say, more money needs to go into defence, which is you make a great case for, at the time when so much money is being diverted to debt service costs, it just creates more stress on the entire system. Look, Paul, I know we've run out of time. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. The book is sensational. I will recommend it as heartily as I can to people to read. Thank you so much for taking this time. As I say, I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. We didn't get around to David Hume, which I'm disappointed about, but perhaps we can do that. I can find out where you have that solitary pint and come and bend your ear about David Hume at some point.
It's been great to talk to you, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you. It's too bad that time constraints ended that conversation when they did, as I honestly could have chatted with Paul for so much longer about the questions raised, not only in global discord, but also unelected power. Both books are available on Amazon and just about every other place you'd expect to find them. And I honestly can't recommend them highly enough. They are superb reads. That's it for me for another edition. I'll be back with a new guest in the very near future. Until then, as always, my thanks to you for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.